Welcome to The Livelihood Show. Discover creative ways to apply your current expertise in new projects and in different environments. Discover the keys to releasing your untapped resources. Reawaken a sense of purpose, passion, and mastery in your working life. Host Marcy Rosenbaum interviews guests who share their personal struggles, surprising choices, and unexpected opportunities as they adapt to changes in the economic and social environment and navigate themselves through new career alternatives. Learn more about today's guest on our Facebook page, Livelihood Creating What's Next, and share your thoughts and experiences on Twitter at hashtag Livelihood Show. And now, welcome to The Livelihood Show.
Welcome to The Livelihood Show. I'm your host, Marcy Rosenbaum. This is the high season in South Beach, Florida, and we revel in the festivals that take advantage of our sunshine and mild weather. Last week's event was the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. I joined veteran blogger and producer Trina Sargalski to check it out. 40 restaurants set up tasting stations, Whole Foods had an entire tasting village serving 7,000 visitors a day. Dozens of winemakers poured nearly 50,000 bottles of wine and spirits. You're given a free personal wine glass courtesy of IKEA when you arrive and a badge holder lanyard to carry it securely around. Organizing a four-day festival of this size is a typical challenge for professionals in the hospitality industry. And that puts Florida International University's Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management right in the center of the action. The festival had its start 11 years ago as a simple Florida Extravaganza Day, sponsored by Food and Wine, and held at FIU's Biscayne Bay campus. Today, the four-day festival spreads out across the sands of Miami's South Beach, hosts over 55,000 guests, and has raised more than $14 million for the school. Since the very beginning, hundreds of FIU students have gained valuable experience by participating in various aspects of the festival. This year, there were 900 FIU students involved in all aspects of hospitality and event management, including sponsorship fulfillment, restaurant and exhibitor recruitment, logistics and inventory, as well as working alongside celebrity chefs, culinary personalities, and winemakers. We met with FIU Dean Mike Hampton at the festival. He gave us an insider's view into the business of hospitality, how it's creating new opportunities for early career, mid-career, and encore career professionals. The art of receiving and entertaining guests and visitors, he said, requires a balance of personal relationships and a surprising ingredient, technology. What does technology, Dean, have to do with the hospitality and tourism business? Isn't it just about the people and the smile and the food and the wine?
No, that's just part of the equation, because that's the way it used to be. But technology is integrated in everything that we do today. One of the things that I like to share with people is that there's a restaurant that started a couple of years ago up in Atlanta called Bones that's using iPads as their menu.
Really?
And they created a dynamic representation of what they had as their offerings. So if a customer comes in and they want to see a photo of what it looks like, it's not just printed. They can go on and see a photo that was actually taken in the kitchen. They may actually be able to see a video of how they prepare that item. They may be able to actually meet the chef who came up with the recipe. They may be able to then click on a link and see what's the kind of wine that would be best with this menu item. So they could actually look maybe at a photograph of the vineyard where the grapes were grown. Mm-hmm. So technology helps us to better merchandise and educate our customer about what it is we have, what we do. And that's just from the merchandising side.
Right.
We use technology, if you look at hotels, let's say, as an example, now we can get better customer information, so we database to a much greater extent than we ever did. So if we know that Marcy has a preference for feather pillows, we can make a note on her guest record so that next time Marcy comes and stays with us, we're going to have that feather pillow waiting for her and she won't have to ask for it the next time. So technology is, we could just go on with examples all day about the kinds of applications where, again, but on every touch point that we have. There was an interesting study that was being done a few years ago by a university where they were using the technology, visual technology, so that if a guest came into a restaurant, the server could say, well, what would you like to drink today? And if the person said, well, I'd like to have a stout beer. So now we know it's a hearty beer. And automatically in the screen, the server would see recommendations for appetizers that would go really well with a stout. So there, we could just, again, like I said, talk many, many examples of how technology is integrated, but it's in everything that we do today.
Well, part of what I'm finding so interesting is all the different fields are starting to become more interconnected. It used to be engineering was engineering, food was food, finance was finance.
Yes.
And especially for people who reinvent their professional identities at different stages of their lives.
Right.
The ability to take what they've learned and mastered in an earlier career and apply it in a new industry is very important.
It certainly is.
Are you finding people coming into your program, the FIU Chaplain School of Hospitality and Tourism Management, are coming back in directly out of high school, college, or are they also coming back mid-career or later career looking for a new application of their skills?
Well, we see both, because we have traditional students that come to us right out of high school and progressively move through. But all the time, we find people who may have retired, and they say, you know, now what? What's next? And because they've had exposure in hospitality in a number of ways, you know, who of us have not stayed in a hotel, or who of us have not been in a restaurant, or who, whatever, right? So now they say, well, that was fun. I want to do something now that I can really enjoy. So they come to us, and maybe they take another degree, or maybe they just take a course or two, or maybe they decide to get a master's degree. But they do come to us for that additional education to learn more about what their passion is.
I always wondered, I know that there's a lot of scholarship money, grant money, loans for traditional students. Is there also money for people who have been laid off, who are downsized? Are there veterans benefits that they can apply towards an additional certificate or training in the food and hospitality business?
Sure, there's a whole range of different resources to be able to help people. Veterans, the question you just asked there, huge resources available through the government to be able to help them to get reacclimated into the mainstream. And so, yes, those are a good example. I'll give you another example of something we're working on now. There's a company called Diageo that has their Latin American and North American headquarters here in South Florida. They've just worked with us to establish a $400,000 grant to help build basic skill sets in underserved markets. So maybe these are individuals that may have done other things in their lifetime and now want to come and learn about hospitality and get those entry-level skill sets. Maybe it's bartending, maybe it's being a server, maybe it's customer service skills to work on a front desk. But there are all kinds of resources like that that are available to help individuals to get reestablished.
And that's very important, because often what's happening, the manufacturing jobs have gone overseas, but you can't outsource hospitality.
No, absolutely not.
What are some of the majors or areas of study that are part of the FIU Chaplain School?
Well, most people think in terms of hotels and restaurants when they think hospitality. But Miami is the cruise capital of the world. So oftentimes we'll suggest to students or prospective students that they really look at the cruise industry. We have all the major cruise lines headquartered here in South Florida. They hire and deploy their team members around the world. So the opportunity for people to work in that sector of industry. But then you've got the spa industry. And you look just here in South Florida, Canyon Ranch alone has tremendous opportunities for students that are into healthful living, where they can now take that and apply it into a hospitality environment and get all kinds of new exposures that students otherwise might not get.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think about clubs. How many golf courses are there that are out here? And all of them have club operations that need hospitality graduates or individuals to be able to. So we prepare students in that area.
Is sports management part of that as well?
Sports management is in our College of Education, but we teach sports tourism. So how do you develop infrastructure to be able to help in operating the types of things that might be like the Olympics or like World Cup soccer or sailing regattas and on and on. So yes, students can go in that direction. One of the things that we're just getting ready to kick off, though, is medical tourism. When you look at the global demand in medical tourism, it is skyrocketing. And a lot of people think oftentimes of Central America, Panama, Costa Rica, where someone may go in to have a particular procedure done. Costa Rica is probably very widely known for dental procedures. So if you have to go in for, let's say, a cosmetic dentistry procedure, you would stay in Costa Rica while you're there, and you'll take advantage of all the things that Costa Rica has to have in addition to going for the treatment. Well, the same thing is happening here in South Florida. The same thing is happening in Europe. It's happening in Asia, all over the world. But who's preparing individuals to be able to go into that sector of the industry?
I see.
Now FIU is going to be standing right at the front of that line and helping our healthcare providers to be able to deal with this new phenomenon.
What is medical tourism?
Well, medical tourism is related to any of the touristic activities that take place as a result of some medical or health-related activity. So let's just take Miami for example. We're the hub for the links to the Caribbean and Latin America. So let's say the major corporations that have operations that may be in any of the islands in the Caribbean. If that individual, let's say that executive, is going to have their annual checkup, their annual physical, where are they going to do that? They could do it with a local doctor, but their corporation is more likely to say, come to Miami and go to either the Jackson Health System or to the Baptist Health System, and they'll go through their stress test. So they have all those procedures done. So when that executive comes in, what do they do with their family? They're not going to leave them back home. They're going to come with them. So they'll dine out in the restaurants. They'll go out to, they may stay in a hotel. They're going to go see some of the attractions. They'll partake in all the kinds of touristic activities that others on vacation might, but they came here as a result of a health-related condition.
I see. It's different than a spa where they might go in order to reduce their blood pressure or to lose some weight. These are actually in partnerships with hospitals and clinics where medical procedures are taking place.
It includes medical procedures. But let's just say that someone has an elective surgery. They're going to go and have a facelift, let's say. Whenever that person then is going to go through the recovery process, in order to reduce scarring, they may go to a spa so that they can get the therapy to help the skin stay malleable in that healing process. Mm-hmm. Well, they might come and stay at one of the spas here in South Florida or anywhere else around the world, and they get to take advantage of all the other spa treatments that might be there, but they may be there specifically for the scar reduction therapies.
Well, that's very interesting. I know in the medical setting, in-hospital stays have been shortened significantly. It used to be if you went in for surgery, you might be there for 5 days or 7 days. Now, almost 24 hours, 36 hours after surgery, you're released.
Exactly.
But in many cases, you still need step-down care.
That's true.
And I now understand that step-down care is partly healthcare-related, but largely hospitality and service-related as well.
Sure. Well, hospitality is being integrated throughout the healthcare system as well as many other sectors of industry. But now healthcare providers have found that when people feel good mentally, they also feel good physically.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you go into a rehabilitation center or into a hospital, now if you get positive attitude from the staff that are there, they treat you nicely, mm-hmm. if the food comes out hot and appealing, now the recovery process is going to be reduced. So now there's a greater interface between hospitality and healthcare in that we're teaching doctors how to be more friendly, to have better bedside manner. How do you teach the nursing and the orderly staff and. All these people now are starting to say, boy, it's not just about taking care of whatever the technical side is of the repair, but now it's also how do we create the right environment and attitudes that help people to get better more quickly.
The other place that the hospitality industry seems to be doing that is with senior services. I remember 30 years ago, I think Marriott was one of the first to get into the business of senior living facilities. Is that part of your curriculum?
Well, we don't go specifically into senior living facilities, but what we teach in the classroom and in the field is all transferable. You know, we don't have a curriculum that's specific to the cruise industry, but the things that we teach them in food service operations and management, in hotel operations and management, in leadership and management skill sets and accounting and all that transfers over. So what we do is we require students to have 1,000 work hours in order to graduate, and we require an additional 300-hour internship. So if a student came to us and said, I'm really interested in working in maybe senior living facilities or working in healthcare, what we would then do is to work with that student to get their work experience applied within that sector, and then their internship would be directed specifically to an organization that would be akin to who they want to work for whenever they graduate. Mm-hmm. So although we may not get the specific exposure on the content in the classroom, they're getting it in the transferability of the applied side when they're out in the field.
Mm-hmm. What other fields do you see emerging or becoming more demanding of trained students and staff over the next 10 or 20 years?
Well, we're going to see hospitality will always be around. It's been around since the cavemen were there, and it will always be a fabric of what we are. What the evolution is that's transpiring is that we really are in a global marketplace today. So we have a greater responsibility to prepare students to have the adaptability to be able to function in almost any location. So whether it's in South Florida, in the United States, in the Caribbean, Latin America, tremendous things are happening in Asia. They're happening in Europe and Africa. So we have to, as we evolve, prepare students not just to know American law, but global law. We have to prepare them to understand marketing from the global context, not just the way we might do it here in the U.S. And it applies in every aspect of the discipline. So that's where we see things evolving. The business will change always, and there are slight improvements like we talked about earlier with technology that change the environment that we have. But the core of what we do will always be the same. It's how that dynamic applies in this new marketplace that's what's going to be our challenge moving forward.
What type of courses would a returning student, someone who is looking to reinvent their lives in the hospitality business and the food or beverage business, what types of courses would they be expected to take?
Well, we can customize the curriculum somewhat to someone that's been around before. If they're going to be in a graduate program, they're going to get more higher level thinking skill sets, because at that level we're teaching them more of the adaptation. They do more research, so they're getting the analytics, the critical thinking skills that they might not have gotten in whatever discipline they were in before. We're teaching a lot more of the technology side, so they're learning electronic distribution, they're learning revenue management, and the things that have really transitioned more significantly out of the core things. Now, everybody can take marketing and human resources and the management and those basic things. It's where you get into those bigger dynamics that we give them the opportunity to take those courses to hone up on what's new, what's going on, and what's new in the business now.
And if you were advising someone who was looking for a second career, who is looking around, as you said earlier, and said, well, what's next? What might you suggest they be looking at in particular?
Well, the one aspect of the hospitality industry where there's some great transferability of different skill sets is in the vacation ownership or shared ownership sector of our business. People think oftentimes in that category of timeshare. Timeshare resorts use the same kind of skill sets that regular hotels do, but they're dealing with owners of those units in that regard. But timeshare hires a lot of people from the banking industry. They hire a lot of people that were in the legal profession before. They hire a lot of marketers from all different aspects of industry. So now they can come into that timeshare or residence clubs and the fractionals and take those skill sets, then learn the uniqueness of what is a residence club and how does it function, and then apply what they've learned in marketing from their previous career in a whole new dynamic.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so we see that as one that's very, very adaptable for someone coming from a different background.
What about languages? What are the language demands that you see with your students, and is a language requirement part of their training?
In fact, the university makes that optional for students because we think that a student should be able to create the kind of foundations that are most appropriate for with the environment where they're going to work. So we wouldn't require language. We do require English because that certainly is the essence of business. And English is the language of business worldwide. So we think that's the best concentration for us. But when advising students, we say to them, it's not just because of South Florida that they should know Spanish. The first language of the U.S. in the next 20 to 30 years will be Spanish.
That's right.
So to be able to interact with cohorts and subordinates, our graduates who will be managing those team members need to be able to relate to them as individuals. So the more they understand the language, the better they can relate and the more effective they will be in setting the leadership and the management of that organization. At the same time, you look at the developments that are taking place in Asia, and China will become the dominant economy of the world. And as a result, the resources that China has to invest in growth worldwide is significant. In fact, we already see that Chinese companies are building hotels in Brazil. They're building resorts in the Bahamas. They're building resorts in Africa. And they're a major real estate developer here in the U.S. So students that want to be able to work for those big global companies that are doing interesting things around the world, they need to be able to not necessarily speak Mandarin fluently, but again, get the essence of what the culture is about. And the essence of the culture comes from the language.
Yes.
So that's where we come from. And talking to students, think about those three things. You need English, language of business, Spanish because it will be the first language of the United States. And the third thing is the Mandarin because the Chinese influence economically worldwide is going to be so significant.
Many colleges have semester abroad programs. Is that part of your curriculum at this point?
In fact, we're so proud of what we do with semester abroad. In the past several years, we've established significant relationships in Europe, Latin America, and Asia to give students the opportunity to be able to take what we're doing in the classroom here and then go see how it's applied in the field in another location. So we have study abroad opportunities for students in Italy. We have opportunities in Switzerland and now Germany. We just signed a memorandum of understanding with a German university this past week.
Very exciting.
We have an opportunity for students to study in Brazil or in Argentina, Chile, and Peru. And, of course, FIU, Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism, actually has a program, a significant program, in Tianjin, which is the port city of Beijing. We have 1,100 students that go to school there full time, and our students from Miami can go over and spend the semester right on site getting the same courses from our same faculty members over in that kind of environment. What better could you ask for?
That's world class.
It's tremendous. In fact, I wish I were a student myself at times so I could take advantage of all these things and go over to have those kinds of insights. Students come back as changed individuals once they go off and they do a study abroad like that. We're also putting together more study tours where they can, and maybe it's just a short-term learning experience. I'll give you an example of one that's absolutely fascinating. In May, Royal Caribbean is repositioning one of their ships to the Mediterranean. So we were able to get space on that ship so that we're taking 57 students who will be able to take three courses on board that ship while it's going across the Atlantic into the Mediterranean. They'll end up in Rome, and they will have completed three courses over that period of time. And a whole group of them, almost 20 students, are going to stay for another term in Genoa and learn cruise management. And it, if you know about Genoa, it's one of the most significant cruise ports in all of Italy.
Well, it has been for almost 1,000 years.
Yes, exactly. Well, Christopher Columbus came from Santa Margarita, which is right next door to Genoa, right?
That's right.
So, yeah. But these are the kinds of things. We're adding more and more of those on so that students will have that opportunity to get that global exposure.
Very exciting. We're at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. Every place I look, I see FIU shirts and hats. You have a lot of staff and faculty actually working here, as well as being a co-sponsor of the festival.
Yes.
What do you hope your students get out of their experience at the Food and Wine Festival?
Well, most importantly, this is a learning opportunity for the students. A lot of people don't realize that just as soon as one festival ends, we begin all of the work and the preparation for the next year. So students get to be involved from the planning stage all the way through execution. Right here on site, we have about 1,200 students that are working throughout the 4 days that are doing everything that you can imagine, invisible positions as well as things that are out behind the scenes. But this didn't just come about during these 4 days. They've been doing preparation work, doing all the schematics, the layouts, design of how everything's going to be happening, all of the ordering of the supplies and the materials. Look at orchestrating the construction of all of the venues of where we're going to be. So students are involved in every aspect. Now, what they're getting is exposure to how do you manage the logistics of marketing an event like this? How do you manage the logistics of the human resources in making sure you've got people in the right places at the right time? How do you find the right fit between a student's qualifications and the need of the job that they're going to perform while they're here? So they learn human resources, they learn marketing, they learn operations, they learn leadership skills, they learn everything that we talk about in the classroom in a real world environment here, which is tremendously exciting for them.
And they learn endurance.
They learned endurance. Yeah, they gotta last the 4 days, right? So you're absolutely right. And of course, it's a lot of fun. They get to get insights. When a student can talk one-on-one with Emeril Lagasse or with Guy Fieri or any of the other celebrity chefs that are here, they may give them a tidbit or a suggestion or a thought that we could say in the classroom, but when it comes from someone that has influence like that, it has so much impact. So these students leave here changed people with new insights, new capabilities they would never be able to get.
And there's a green component as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is. In fact, we have an entire team of people that are working aggressively to ensure that we look at the entire recycling and conservation considerations that go into the operation of the festival. So there's an army of students that come from our sustainability program here at FIU that have been working with us.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
We appreciate the opportunity.
According to Elaine Walker at the Miami Herald, more than 58,000 people attended this year's South Beach Wine and Food Festival. It raised about $2 million to benefit the FIU University Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management and the Southern Wine and Spirits Beverage Management Center. And as we're about to hear, it raised more than money. It produced thousands of pounds of food that was prepared and not served and was destined to be thrown away until it was rescued, thanks to the organization Feeding South Florida and its tireless director of food procurement, Brian Fellin. Over 4 days, over 30,000 pounds of leftovers were collected. FIU students in the hospitality and social welfare programs collected them from the Tasting Village, packaged them in trays, loaded them on refrigerated trucks, and sent them to 10 local soup kitchens awaiting their arrival. There's a story here about food recovery and one about career reinvention. How does a food and wine pro like Brian Fellin discover a new meaning for the idea of food service? How did he redirect his career and professional identity from restaurateur to food rescuer? Hi, Brian. You spent many years working in the food service business. What triggered such a significant career shift?
Yeah, I had managed restaurants for, good 25 years and just got frustrated with the amount of plates that we'd put down in front of people and them say, no, I don't want that just by looking at it. And it was perfectly good food that because of the guidelines and health reasons, you can't serve it to anyone else. So it has to be thrown away, and the amount of plates that were wasted, perfectly good meals.
You know, a lot of people feel that way, but have no idea what to do about it. Where did you go to find out how to do that?
Well, you know what, to a point, I was extremely fortunate because of the fact that they already had that in place. So when I worked in Manhattan, worked in restaurants there, we dealt with City Harvest.
Okay.
And we would package up food for City Harvest at the end of the day. And they would pick it up and then take it to the soup kitchens and whatnot to serve people in need. So when I started to look, when I was up in New York, I started looking at the City Harvest and Island Harvest up there, and they didn't have anything available. But I had worked down in Florida more than a dozen years ago. I worked on South Beach on Lincoln Road.
Where?
A place called the Brasserie, the ill-fated Brasserie. And I decided to expand my search. At the same time, my daughter was looking to go to college at FSU.
Uh-huh. Perfect.
So I thought that, all right, well, you know what, let me get a head start. But I made contact with the Daily Bread Food Bank, and we started exchanging emails, myself and the human resource person. And as I was doing more homework into the Daily Bread Food Bank, I found that the executive director was someone that I worked with a dozen years ago at the Brasserie.
Ah.
My food background, my restaurant background wasn't sufficient enough. I also did a couple of years doing sales work, mm-hmm. and it was the sales work that helped kind of push me over the edge as far as being a viable candidate. I said, look, I'm eager to do this. I have the background. I can knock on the doors. It doesn't matter what situation I'll walk into. I could be out in the field with a farmer, or I could be in Publix with, you know, someone, the district manager. It doesn't matter.
Right.
And I'll just speak to them, and just because the importance of this and the fact that we have to stop wasting so much of the food that we produce, and there's so many people that are in need, it's a crime.
Brian, what do you think it was that flipped that switch for you, that made you realize that you really needed to do something about this?
When I made the little transition from the restaurant world into sales world, I was selling restaurant supplies. I thought, all right, let me see about this. And I didn't feel any sense of fulfillment. And I kept thinking back to Island Harvest and City Harvest and how I used to package up food for them. I'm like, you know what, let me just get involved and I'll just jump into it. And when I started doing some more research, I found that these weren't only volunteer opportunities. They were also opportunities that you could work and be paid for.
Aha, okay, great.
So at the same time, you know, I could make a living doing that, but helping people in need. And I thought, you know what, this is the niche.
Right.
I'll be able to help people and reduce some of that waste that's out there. That's just so incredibly frustrating.
How did you get into the food service business to start with?
Way back when, I mean, even starting in fast food while I was going to high school, college, I worked in Fridays way back when and then started bartending.
Uh-huh.
And then I got involved in management, and then I was managing for years. And then it just started to lose some of the magic. I'm like, because I was always passionate about it. I love the excitement of it. I love being able to put out a product, make someone's week. You know, for a lot of people, going out to dinner was a once-a-month thing. And if I could make it something a little extra special, that was awesome.
Right, right.
But then it started to lose that a little bit. And that's when I started looking like there's more.
Right.
If I may, one of the companies I did sales for, I was regularly on the phone with people in nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I was speaking with them and just hearing them. And just hearing it, and I would speak to people that had, for lack of a better term, you know, the regular jobs and careers. But then I'd speak to some of these folks in nonprofit, and they were light. You could feel it through the phone, their passion. They were just so lit up, and they were so happy to talk about it and talk about their mission. And it was uplifting, and that's when I just started. I said, I have to make a change. I have to make a change, and I'm so happy that I did.
Food rescue is also called food recovery. It's the practice of safely recovering perfectly edible food that would otherwise get thrown away. Recovered food is edible, but often not saleable. Restaurants might have made too much or perhaps ordered more ingredients than they could use in preparation for an event. Nearly 49 million people in the United States suffer from hunger, according to the Congressional Record. That's roughly 1 in 6 of the U.S. population, and it's the highest ever recorded in the United States. And yet, more than 33 million tons of food are wasted each year. And the cost for disposal are in the billions of dollars, according to U.S. government estimates. When need and opportunity and innovation intersect, you have social entrepreneurship. A social entrepreneur recognizes a social problem and uses entrepreneurial principles to organize, create, and manage a venture to achieve social change. While a business measures performance in profit and return to stockholders, the main aim of social entrepreneurship is to further social and environmental goals. By giving businesses an alternative to spending money to dump food, for example, food recovery organizations could offer them a cost-effective alternative that gives them a positive return on investment, both financial and social. Brian Fellin and Feeding South Florida are great examples of social entrepreneurship in action. But Brian didn't have a business card that said social entrepreneur. His skills, his vision, and his passion showed him the way to a personal career path that was both fulfilling and sustainable. How do you go about identifying opportunities for food rescue?
I'll take a look at the event itself, you know, the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, or when the Super Bowl was here, the size of the event, what type of event, you know, how much food will they be preparing? Right. South Beach Wine and Food Festival, you cannot run out of food. So they have to over-prepare. How much they over, you know, what their margin is of over-preparing, you know, does change a little bit, but they have to over-prepare. So I take a look at those opportunities and the investment that you have to put into it. And this one, it's worked out really well. The amount of food that we've been able to rescue from that event and the amount of people we've been able to help has just been incredible. And I look forward to it every year, to the challenge of it, the challenge of working the weekend and just trying to get creative and find more ways to, you know, save more food or help more people.
Events and festivals appear to be a goldmine for food rescue. These annual events are very large scale. Do you also have programs in place where you can rescue prepared food from other major kitchen facilities?
Well, we have a program called the Extra Helpings Program where we pick up prepared food from, you know, several hospitals. We pick it up from, there's some universities, Miami University, we pick up from them. And we pick up from some small, you know, some restaurants, from Longhorn to Red Lobster. So we pick up from them and even some smaller facilities. Looking at the big events where they have to prepare a lot of food, I key into those that I know that, fine, we can turn around and pick up 10,000 pounds at the commissioner's dinner that they had for the Super Bowl up at the Broward Convention Center a few years ago.
I see.
So I know that those events, the chefs have no choice but to over-prepare. They cannot run out for that clientele. So those are the ones I start looking for and to focus on.
I don't think I fully realize that they are leftovers, but they're unserved leftovers.
Yeah, because once it's in front of a guest, can't take it. If it's in a buffet line, you know, people take a look at sweet tomatoes and some other, you know, some of the other buffet houses and wonder why we can't pick up from there. Once that food is out, I can't do anything with that because people, you know, breathing on it, you don't know what they may have or may not have. And so that's not anything that we can, for health reasons, take. Anything that has not gone out, though, I'm after it.
And you really, I guess, need to be a chef or in the food industry to understand, if you will, the supply chain of food preparation to know when you can, in fact, come in and rescue food.
My experience being in the restaurants definitely hasn't hurt me. And that's why I knew that the fact that we were only picking up 5,000 pounds of food from the South Beach Wine and Food Festival in 2009, that there was, something wasn't right.
Right.
That, so I knew that these chefs had to over-prepare. I knew the vendors had to prepare. So that's why I put my, I invested time and energy with my team. I'm like, guys, there's an opportunity here, and I think we need to really explore it. And my team was fully supportive. And it's worked out really well. And FIU and John Bushman and Kelly Murphy, Chef Michael Moran, they've been phenomenal.
What did you have to do to make the shift from grabbing the opportunity at 5,000 pounds to connecting with the chefs in the preparation and sequence so that you became part of the process?
Marcy, it came down to, honestly, having my truck there and me not shutting up for 2 days. I had to talk to everybody that came by. I was making them aware of what we were doing. I was talking to everybody. I was a little bit, you know, I was constantly pushing, like, hey, you know, is there food up there? Can we get some, you know, get some food? Don't throw it away. And passing out my card and just constantly talking to people, trying to make them aware, getting students engaged. And that's where the help of with FIU and John Bushman, who's with FIU and does just such an incredible job coordinating a variety of things, it's helped immeasurably. Well, now it is measurably, matter of fact.
Yes. What are some of the numbers?
Well, we went from 5,000 to 23,000. Then last year was over 28,000, and this year I know I'm going to be over 30,000.
30,000 pounds of rescued food.
Correct. And it'll be a wide variety because people, at times, you know, I'm like, fine, guys, I'll take soda, I'll take cups, I'll take this. So it's food and grocery products that I'll take. That at times they're like, you know what, it costs us more to ship it back or more to put it back into the warehouse than it does to donate it.
That makes a festival like a wine and food festival really worth doing. It's not just for fundraising or for PR purposes. It becomes a community sustainability effort as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I have to say that if it was strictly for a fundraising opportunity, Marcy, to tell you the truth, going around the clock basically from 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday till 5:30 in the morning, Sunday,
right?
It has to be about something more.
Right.
As much as fundraising is very important to every organization, it has to be about the fact that you know that there's some family somewhere now that's going to be able to eat because of the fact that you put in this effort.
Well, that's right. I mean, the volunteers who were serving the wine to the festival goers were happy to leave at the end of the day. Your crew, which was rescuing food, was working well beyond the hours of the folks that were part of the event itself.
I had a group of volunteers from FIU who were in the social welfare curriculum. I mean, they got there at 9 o'clock on Saturday, and they stayed there and worked with me until 5:30 in the morning. And it was incredible. They had smiles on their face.
Right.
And anytime they looked like they were getting a little tired, I explained to them, you know, exactly what this meant.
Right.
And they were energized, and they were such an incredible help and blessing to have there.
Is there an accounting process with this as well? I mean, are there regulations in terms of you're needing to track what comes from who and where it goes to and how long?
Only in some situations. There's some folks that donate to us that I'll know, like if I received, you know, 4 pallets of ketchup or something that's that distinct, I'll know how many pounds it is that they contact me. Then I can, you know, write them out a letter of donation. And
right.
Give them a donation receipt. When it's the queue or Burger Bash, it's
right.
Impossible.
Right.
You know, I can't have specific person unless I see, you know, 15, 25, 35, you know, cases of Allen steaks or burgers or the 75 cases of Sonic hot dogs that I received.
So in a sense, a lot of it is standing by and seeing when they're making a shift or when they're making a decision which would waste food, and you and your team are able to swoop in and redirect it.
That's part of also what I've been real happy with is in speaking with FIU. This year I was able to get to 3 classes mm-hmm. and speak with them about the event and what Feeding South Florida was doing there. And the students were extremely receptive and enthusiastic. As a matter of fact, there were 2 students who were at the Bobby Flay event at the mm-hmm. Raleigh Hotel on Saturday night. And they came over all excited because they knew our truck was there. And they said, they told everyone there, stop. They were about to throw the food away. They said, stop. We know Feeding South Florida's over there. Stop. They came running over from the Raleigh onto the beach where we were. And it said, you have tins, you know, there's going to be food, they're throwing it out,
right.
And we're going to stop them. And we ended up picking up a few hundred pounds from that event.
It's really a rescue.
Yeah.
How do you figure out where to distribute that food to?
We have different agencies that do different things. You know, it could be Miami Rescue has a steam table. They're able to serve some of this food and reheat it easily.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it could be Boca Helping Hands, the Soup Kitchen, Camilla's House. Love Thy Neighbor. There's just a variety of agencies that we can do that with. Mm-hmm. There's also an agency called His Place Ministries, run by Pastor Tom LaPointe, and they don't really have access to a whole lot of cooking equipment. They maybe have a microwave. Mm-hmm. His ministry, he serves the people that work the tracks. So from Calder Raceway to Gulfstream Raceway and mm-hmm. some of the tracks, the guys that work in the back who are the hot walkers and take care of the horses and the grooms, right. Some of those guys are, you know, they follow the horses. So they don't have access to a lot of food. They're not making a whole lot of money. And he needs ready-to-eat food.
Right.
So when I get cases or I get, like, there were a bunch of Reuben sandwiches that looked fantastic, and they were mini Reuben sandwiches, and I saw those, I'm like, set those aside. I know where they're going.
Great.
So when I saw the cases of the hot dogs, even from Sonic, I'm like, set them aside. I know who to. And Tom came down Sunday morning, right after church. I called him almost in the middle of it, and I said, I'll meet you here. I said, I have some stuff for you. He came down, filled up his van, and he was out distributing that till about 9 o'clock Sunday night.
That's a remarkable story.
You can't build to a point like a cookie cut, you know, just say, all right, this is the way it is, every single thing. You have to go with what you managed to rescue.
Right.
And you have to make those decisions right then and there. So that's why, to a point, trying to train someone to do that, you know, I'd like to be able to do that, but I'm still kind of, I have to be at every event.
Right.
I have to be there and see.
It's recognizing an opportunity when it arrives.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's opportunities for beverage. I mean, water. You know, because there were people out there, my volunteers, they're like, they saw I had opportunities to rescue Pepsi and I had opportunities to rescue water. I said, do me a favor, let the Pepsi be. They're like, why? I said, take the water. Everybody will always need water. Water's first. So if you have to make the choice between saving that water or saving the Pepsi, let the Pepsi go.
Right, right.
You know, and it's protein and produce.
Right.
When you go through the tent, and I try to teach everyone, I said, you save protein and produce. They said, what about bread? I said, nobody's going to pick up the bread and take it away. Don't worry. You can go back for that. You leave a bunch of burgers there, or you leave a bunch of produce and apples or whatever, they're going to take those.
I see.
Because at times there's other people there that are trying to take items away from these events. So that's why you have to hustle.
Really? Who else is there?
You might have people doing the rebuild who haven't, you know, been working 8-hour shifts and they need a bite to eat. And
okay.
I'm not begrudging anyone, but I just know that my mission is to try and help those people that have absolutely nothing.
There's
cleaning crews, there's all kinds of folks that historically you have to try and work faster than they do. We've done food rescues from like food shows from Cisco and some other major food distributors where it's the same thing. You just have to be quicker. You got to hustle and you're going to sweat.
Brian Fellin is a member of a growing community of people who want to do meaningful work as professionals, not only as volunteers. Mark Friedman kicked off this phenomenon with his 2007 book, Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life. He envisioned tapping the energy from the What's Next baby boomers, their work lives, and their desire for a deeper sense of social purpose. The creation of the think tank Civil Ventures was launched from this idea. Today, Civil Ventures' Encore Career Campaign aims to engage millions of people, combining personal meaning, continued income, and social impact to produce a windfall of talent available to solve society's greatest problems. Civic Ventures demonstrates that the value of experience makes a difference in solving serious social problems in education, the environment, healthcare, and homelessness. All of us can lend a hand by making sandwiches or serving meals at a soup kitchen. Creating scale and sustainability takes a restaurateur who understands the food preparation cycle, food safety rules and regulations, and the ability to operate on a large scale under tight timeframes. Brian Fellin's new career path as director of food procurement was possible because he found a way to link his passion with his experience and sense of purpose. When someone makes a change and brings with them a set of experience and a set of skills like you do, the ability to make a difference is accelerated because it's not just the passion now, but it's the passion and the knowledge of how you can do something bigger and better than it's ever been done before.
Yeah, I mixed, a skill set that, for a period of time I was, kind of wondering and worrying about, with this skill set, what am I going to be able to do? I don't want to be in the restaurants anymore.
Right.
And then this, all of a sudden, this opportunity came out. And I have to tell you, when after going through my meetings and finding out I got the job, I packed up my car. It's supposed to take 23 and a half hours to get down here. I got here in 25 from Long Island.
From Long Island? Where on Long Island?
I was in like Huntington at the time, and I packed up, and I was so excited to get here, and I slept for about an hour and 15 minutes. I don't drink coffee, and I was wide awake. I was just adrenaline the whole time.
You were charged. It's almost like you got plugged into a power source.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way I felt. That's the way I felt. My friends kept checking on me. They're like, "You okay?" And then they would talk to me. They're like, "You sound like you got like a 10-hour. You slept for 10 hours." I said, "No." I said, "Right now, I'm so excited about this." And I was watching, just watching the scenery. Basically, as I was coming down, it was summertime, so at least I wasn't fighting the snow. But when I came down in August, but it just I still remember so clearly.
How long ago was that?
I came down in the summer of 2009.
Okay.
After the South Beach Wine and Food was that winter in February, and I was down in late July, early August.
Are there any food festivals in South Florida that you're not yet connected to that you would love to be connected to?
You know what? I have to explore. I honestly have to dig into that a little more. There's some festivals that I don't know if they're as large as this one. It does take a lot of manpower, and quite honestly, without having the partnership of FIU, it does make it a little challenging.
Right.
We do have a very good volunteer coordinator here, but I'm looking at some other opportunities. I don't have any specific. I've heard about Seafood Festival and some of these other festivals, but you also have to get some. You have to get the buy-in from them as well.
Right. There's a special feeling in feeding someone, I think, that is a form of giving all its own.
I've gotten hugs from people that, some of the toughest looking guys you ever saw who had tears in their eyes when I dropped off, when I'd pull up at 1 o'clock in the morning with food for them after that event, and
right.
They had tears in their eyes. And, getting a hug from those guys, or having a pastor who just every time she sees me, just thank you. She's asking me if I'm okay. And I'm like, "I'm fine." She goes, "Well, I need you strong."
Right.
She goes, "You've just made such a difference for so many people, and just want to make sure you're okay." I'm like, "I'm good. I'll keep going. Don't worry."
Okay, well, you are still in your recuperation phase from the South Beach Wine and Food Festival last week, but I understand what your friends were thinking when you drove down from Long Island in 25 hours. You sound great.
Thank you.
Brian, have a great rest of the day.
You as well. It's been my pleasure.
You do amazing work.
Thank you so much.
Like Brian, many people are determined to apply their experience to make a difference for others. Some can afford to do so as unpaid volunteers, but most are looking to combine some aspect of work, income, and benefits with elements of service. Encore Careers combine social impact, personal fulfillment, and continued income, purpose, passion, and a paycheck. Civic ventures and think tanks across the United States are finding ways that they think will make it easier for individuals to pursue Encore Careers and for organizations to find and connect with them. Unleashing this vast potential requires fresh attitudes, policies, and practices. Currently, people find themselves trying to manage this transition on their own with few guideposts, support, often roadblocks at every turn. But according to new research for MetLife Foundation and Civic Ventures Projects, there will be more jobs than people to fill them by 2018. And their research suggests that those 55 and older who have the skills and experience will be able to bridge those critical gaps and find a way to make a difference in education, healthcare, and the green economy. Civil Ventures has a number of interesting initiatives underway. One is Encore.org, a website providing advice, resources, news, and connections for individuals and organizations. They have something called the Purpose Prize. These are $100,000 grants to people who discover new opportunities, invent new programs, and foster lasting change. They have a program called Encore Fellowships. These are paid, time-limited assignments placing highly skilled and experienced professionals at the end of their midlife careers into positions in social purpose organizations. They have Encore College Initiative that provides grants to community colleges helping boomers retool for health, green, education, and nonprofit jobs, and something called the Launchpad, a contest awarding mini-grants of $5,000 to budding entrepreneurs, 45 and older, to help them build and launch a social entrepreneurship idea. Thanks to everyone for being part of the Livelihood community. Our guests this week were Mike Hampton, Dean of FIU Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management, and Brian Fellin, the Director of Food Procurement for Feeding South Florida. And here's a shout-out to South Florida organizations. If your organization is interested in donating food or volunteer time to Feeding South Florida, please contact Brian Fellin at bfellin@feedingsouthflorida.org. And it's spelled bphelan@feedingsouthflorida.org. We'll also have a link on our website. My recommended audiobook of the week, Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life by Mark Friedman and narrated by Sean Pratt. Encore tells the stories of pathfinders who are moving beyond midlife careers but refusing to phase out or fade away. As they search for a calling in the second half of life and focus on what matters most, these individuals are standing in positions to transform the nature of work and retirement in America. As a member of the Livelihood community, you can get this audiobook at a discount. Just go to audibletrial.com/Marcy. For more information about our guests and their ideas, check out our website, livelihoodshow.com. Follow us on Twitter, @livelihoodshow, and like our Livelihood page on Facebook to get regular updates. For The Livelihood Show, I'm Marcy Rosenbaum. Until next time, keep up the good work.
Thanks for listening to Livelihood, creating what's next on your personal career path. Your host, Marcy Rosenbaum, is a speaker and workshop leader who can help your group or organization imagine what's next. For more information, contact Marcy at livelihoodshow.com. You can learn more about our guests and their stories on our weekly blog at livelihoodshow.com. And you can order a transcript of the show right from our online store. Livelihood listeners are innovative pathfinders developing satisfying work and professional alternatives in the new economy. If you have a story, project, or product you want us to know about, send us an email at producer@livelihoodshow.com. For The Livelihood Show, I'm Kevin Lockhart. Until next time, keep up the good work.